okay? Now, if you still want to get your name in magazines, he wants $500 a month.
Where does it come from? We work one gig this month. And now, so what do we get, $200 for this gig up here, if we're lucky? If we're lucky, we'll get $200. And it'll be 2 weeks before we get it, probably. I mean, after all, what is all this shit in the newspaper? If we got such a big name, how come? We're starving, man. This fucking band is starving. Man. And we've been starving for 3 years. I realize it takes a long time, but goddamn, does it take another 5-10 years from now?
There's some months when you're not going to work as much as other months. There's some months when you're going to make a lot of money. And if you average it out, you do make more than $200 a month.
Expenses are sure high, too. If we'd all been living in California, it would have been different.
If we'd all been living in California, you wouldn't work at all.
That's true. Well, we're not working now anyway. We worked one gig this month, Frank. What's wrong with getting 2 months in a row of this good money? Or 3 months in a row? Then we can afford to take 3 or 4 months off, and everybody can... After the first month, I can get just enough ahead, but if I had 2 more months, man, I'll get ahead. Because I'm not living very extravagantly, I'll tell you for sure.
This is KZSU, Stanford, at the western edge of the western world, where the sun goes under and things are different. If we'd all been living in California working for Frank Zappa, we'd all be starving. If you average it out, it comes to more than $200 a month. Come on, Frank, you can do better than that. Starvation wages notwithstanding, I'll take the mothers of invention over the gluttonous Silicon Valley any day. Better Uncle Meek than the Facebook boys or our California musketeers. Did I say our California musketeers? I meant our Tesla suzerains. Ain't too cool. To all you members of the Lean Brigade, welcome back to Entitled Opinions. No starving band members here, but an ongoing feast. Today I'm back in the studio of KZSU with writer and journalist Scott Thomas Anderson. 3 months ago, on January 18th to be exact, we aired a show with Scott on California writers, where we focused on a few 19th century figures, among them Ambrose Bierce, John Rollin Ridge, and A. May Crocker. We promised to follow that show up with California Writers Part 2, and here we are ready to go. Before we get started, a quick reminder that Scott Anderson has been writing and producing a documentary podcast series called Drinkers with Writing Problems, which explores the connection between drinking cultures and creative literary legacies. Season 1 includes episodes written and recorded in Ireland, Scotland, Spain, New Orleans, and Hollywood. Season 2 premiered this past January and features some California writers. The documentary series is available on most podcast platforms. Really great stuff, well worth tuning into. Scott Thomas Anderson, welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
Good to be back.
So in my introduction to our previous show, I mentioned in passing Frank Zappa's line about if we'd all been living in California, and a few listeners wrote in wanting to know where the quote came from. So I thought I would start today by playing that clip. It's actually an exchange between Zappa and one of his band members that by chance was caught on tape in the recording studio. And typical Frank Zappa, Zappa included it on his album Uncle Meat. Anyway, thanks for bearing with me there. Multum in parvo, there is much in little, that Latin phrase applies to our show today because instead of talking about a slew of 20th century California writers, which we could have done, we've decided, like last time, to limit ourselves to 3, maybe 4 of them, and they're not the most well-known names by any means. We're going to start with the poet Robinson Jeffers, then move on to the novelist Oakley Hall, and then on to the gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson. They're very interesting writers and characters, and you've written profiles of all three of them for the San Francisco Chronicle. So let's get going with Robinson Jeffers. Many, if not most of our listeners, have probably never heard of him. So could you tell us who Jeffers was and why, in your entitled opinion, he is such a significant literary figure?
I think Jeffers, he is a poet who died in 1960, who seems to be made for the moment we're in right now in terms of this prophetic view he had of where we were going with the natural world and the kind of jeopardy and danger we would ultimately end up in through the kind of hubris that's natural to our species, I guess. And so Jeffers was born in Pennsylvania in 1887. He'd come out to California just after the turn of the century to study medicine and forestry. And I think that's very significant in how he ultimately developed creatively in his approach to nature writing, because he becomes arguably one of the most important nature writers in the history of the American West Coast, if not the nation. In around 1918, about the time he had decided he really didn't want to do forestry full time, he also didn't want to be a doctor. These were careers that he had thought long and hard about and had a lot of training for, but he ultimately felt the call of poetry and literature. And so in 1918, he moved to Carmel, California. And for your listeners that don't know, in 1918, it was just a tiny hamlet along the Big Sur coastline. It's not terribly bigger today, but it's certainly more developed and more people living there. But it was a very small town when he moved there in 1918. And he bought a piece of property with his wife, Una, on a bluff overlooking the Pacific coast and this sort of bluff that overlooked the waves crashing against the rocks below. Very majestic view that he had. And he, over time, started both writing poetry about the landscape and the wilderness that he observed all around him in the Big Sur area of the coastline. And also he was, at the same time, he was slowly, by hand, building a house and a tower out of stones. And ultimately he built this place today we call Tor House and Hawk Tower. And it's very difficult to describe to someone who hasn't seen it. It's this very evocative, strange-looking house and tower that's built out of rocks and stones that came from all over the world. People who would visit him and bring him stones from all over the globe. A lot of the rocks and stones came from the natural landscape where he was living. And he started writing poems that we would essentially call nature poems. It's been argued by writers like Dana Gioia that Jeffers is the most important nature writer in American history, more so than people like Robert Frost, because he could channel his observations and experience into his lines in a very powerful way without making the poet, making humanity the center of what was happening in the poem. And so it's a much more pure, raw connection to the natural experience. It's striving to not project the human lens on it so much and understand it for what it is. So he established a pretty wide audience and became very well known. But then sort of in the middle period of his life, he had two sons he was very close to that were young men when World War II started, and Jeffers was very much against the war. And he wrote a poetry collection called The Double Axe that really, really hurt his reputation in terms of there was a sort of a patriotic fervor going on in the country at the time, and The Double Axe was very much against the war. Some people read into it that it was somehow dismissive or apologetic for what fascist forces were doing in other parts of the world, but it was more just an anti-war piece of literature and with a lot of concerns about maybe the benefits of isolation from world conflict. But in the moment, it did not go over very well, and it absolutely sort of destroyed his professional reputation for years, if not decades. The other reason people may not have heard of Jeffers is there's been kind of a, in some corners of critical circles in academia, there's been sort of a concerted effort to dismiss and forget him. He's certainly never been popular with certain quarters of the critical establishment and the academic establishment because he takes such a different tact on nature writing than virtually almost any other nature writer or poet or novelist that you would think of. So there's the problem of how you fit him into canonical thinking, and then there's also the problem of groupthink in terms of what's good. And if you have one writer who's just so far off course and charting his own path to that degree, then maybe he doesn't get the attention one would think he would get. But he became an incredible influence on a lot of important writers. So even though his name began to fade a bit after the 1940s, he would have been a very well-known writer between the 1920s and the 1940s. And then after because of what happened in World War II and the fallout from that, his name did start to recede. He did get a lot less attention for himself and his work. But at that same time, he was becoming profoundly influential on a whole host of important people. To start with, the famous mythologist Joseph Campbell was a big fan of Jeffers' work. John Steinbeck was living just down the road from him when he was a young writer starting out. John Steinbeck was living over in Pacific Grove, not far from where Jeffers was in Carmel, and discovered his work and really admired it. I believe he went and visited him once, but was a sort of kind of admiring from a close distance, but he thought he was amazing. And so did Steinbeck's famous biologist friend, Doc Ricketts. They both thought Jeffers' writing was incredible, and they loved his approach to nature and the wilderness and the wild and the sea. The groundbreaking photographer Ansel Adams was, in a sense, a disciple of Jeffers. He often said he was trying to do with photography what Jeffers did with poetry. Later down the road, Jeffers influenced more contemporary writers that your listeners would know today, some of whom they might guess, like the poet Gary Schneider or the poet Dana Gioia. These are hugely influenced by Jeffers. But also Charles Bukowski. I would always say Jeffers was one of his favorite writers. Well, that was a surprise to me. I wouldn't have assumed that connection. So his creative atoms are sort of spread out everywhere. And the other thing I think that is just absolutely fascinating about him is in 1960, before he died, he wrote one of his last poems was a vision of the polar ice caps melting and swallowing all the coastal cities and sort of entombing them in mausoleums of ocean life again. And the reason that's interesting to me is the term global warming didn't exist in 1960. It wasn't part of the popular lexicon until the mid-80s. Climate change was not well understood in 1960s, and yet Jeffers' connection to nature seems to have been so mysterious and profound in ways that are hard to understand that he could see it before, definitely before other writers. He could see it all ahead of them.
Yeah. So in terms of his style, understand is the wrong word, but I can see why he was never a popular academic poet. I mean, a poet for the academics, because he's not a modernist in any classical sense of modernist poetry. As you said, you know, the whole realm of subjectivity is taken out as much as he could from the poems. And yet there is nothing conservative about the verse that you read. He is, the idiom is distinctly modern. It's not sentimentalizing poetry at all. And it's very hard to categorize. And this attempt to allow the object to become the center of you know, the poetry is sometimes there's not a lot academics can do with this kind of poetry because it doesn't lend itself to elaborate explanations. And let me show you what you haven't seen in this poem, all those things that are hidden and that the professor ends up looking very brilliant when he or she illuminates all the subtexts and invocations and metaphors. Anyway, would you consider him a did he have a mystical temperament? Because if he did, it doesn't really come through in his poetry in the, at least the typical genre of mysticism where you have this very palpable longing for the infinite or the transcendent. My impression, and I have read Jeffers, a couple of his books of poetry, my impression is that he is very much attuned to the specific surroundings in which he finds himself.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think whatever mystical wonders exist in the universe for Jeffers are right in front of you if your eyes are open and if you're listening and if your senses are sort of alive to what's around you. One thing I would ask you about from the academic perspective is, do you think the overarching themes of his poems are part of why he's not of interest? Because, he a couple times in his career, I believe he referred to himself this way. Definitely the term cropped up around him, whether it started with him or not, but I think it started with him, was he called himself an anti-humanist. And by that he meant that he just did not think humanity had to be at the center of not only the universe, but the natural cycles of the world. And if you have any friends that are biologists or physicists, I mean, that's just a given. Yeah. But within the humanities, it's
but again, it's hard for the academic humanities to have a lot of work to do with someone for whom humanity is not at the center of the story.
That view of his also led him to be accused by some critics as being a misanthrope. There's a line in Hurt Hawks where he says, "I would sooner kill a man than a hawk." And lines like that have caused some to, very much like Mark Twain in his later years, this idea has grown up that Jeffers was a bit of a misanthrope. And I actually think the argument holds more water with Twain in his later years than Jeffers. But I don't agree that either of them work. I just don't personally believe anybody would go through all the emotional and psychic labor of writing if they were truly a misanthrope. What would be the point? But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that it's very difficult for nature poets, genuine nature poets, to get much of a hearing in academic humanities. For some reason, the academy is almost, you feel like people have distanced themselves and put nature as far away from, the horizon of consciousness. I've done a show on the poet A.R. Ammons, who is in my view, if Jeffers is the great nature poet of the pre-war period, I think Ammons is the great American nature poet of the post-war period, and very modern, very, brilliant poetically, and yet it's hard for him to get any kind of traction among academics because academics are much more at home in the urban world and with the urban psyche. And so it's a hard sell, and it doesn't necessarily have to do with Jeffers being a misanthrope or perceived as a misanthrope. I just think, and it's surprising because eco-criticism is a huge sector of the literary humanities nowadays, not only literary, and you would think that Jeffers would be rediscovered big time, but I don't know, maybe you would know better than me whether whether there was a perception of his political leanings that might play into
he was reputation. I think he was viewed as a political contrarian for the most part, but it's a very simplistic way to look at him. But I do think that's the treatment he got at the time as being an out of touch political contrarian, not understanding the threat that the Axis powers posed to the freedom of the world. And I understand that entirely, why that would be perplexing at the time, given what was happening. But it was just his view and prism that no country should be contributing to the conflict, and that it would just lead to more death and destruction and possibly the end of the planet. And of course, now we're all thinking about those questions again this year. But he's a very interesting writer, and he's very attuned to some writers who came before him, such as Wordsworth. He's also very similar to some writers who came just after him or that had a little crossover with him. But yeah, when you talk to some of our great poets that are in California today, such as Dana Gioia or Gary Schneider, I mean, it's his influence is just incredible.
Yeah. So we want to move on because we have another two writers to cover in our show, and we're just going to have to encourage our listeners to go and read Jeffers on their own and see what they make of him. Is there one particular volume or a title or things that you would recommend?
I would just go to poetry.org, and they have a lot of his very straightforward but beautiful and intriguing nature poems are on there. So Hurt Hawk, Carmel Point, they're not long poems either. You can read them very quickly,
And definitely the flavor of California, I mean, that coast.
Yeah, for your listeners who have not been to the Monterey, Carmel area, that particular area enjoyed two incredible writers between Jeffers and John Steinbeck, both being based there. And between Jeffers' poetry, which is so sort of intensely focused on the landscape and the wildlife, and then Steinbeck, which is sort of how do communities in that area of and all social strata interact with that those landscapes and wildlife that Jeffers is writing about. Between the two writers, you can get a sense of just what an incredibly beautiful part of the world that it is.
Yeah. So that's a kind of bioregional dimension keep in mind. Now, we're staying within the same general bioregional area when we move on to Oakley Hall, who was more of a San Francisco-based, eventually. Not a poet, a novelist, as well as an essayist. And why did you choose Oakley Hall in this reduced canon of our three writers?
To start with, full disclosure, he's one of my favorite novelists, but also because some of our greatest known novelists working today in California, the novelists we have that have readers all over the world, sort of agree that he is vastly underappreciated, and that he is, like Jeffers, a massive influence on the California literary voice of the second half of the 20th century. So Oakley Hall was actually directly a teacher of Michael Chabon, Louis B. Jones, Amy Tan, Richard Ford. So very well-known and highly esteemed California writers. Actually, Oakley Hall taught them, and they all seem to have walked away with believing that that was critical and pivotal to their development as writers. So there's this influence to start with, but I probably would focus just more on the fact that he was a great novelist. So he's born in Southern California in the San Diego area, and, I believe in the 20s. By the time World War II happened, he was a teenager, and he, like almost all young men his age, he went into the war and he served in the war. As soon as the war was over, he got married and he moved to San Francisco, and he started working towards his career as a novelist. His first couple novels were sort of contemporary fictions, pretty straightforward, but very well-written books just about sort of life and development in life. But then he began trying his hand in different forms of genre writing. And this is another interesting thing that might be worth talking about. There is a question with some of his pupils, his students, his disciples about whether that is why he's not better remembered or better appreciated by the critical establishment, is because so much of his great accomplishments as a writer were in genre fiction.
Westerns
and crime novels. For my money, he's one of the best Western novelists ever, along with Cormac McCarthy. So those are who I think are the two best that I've read. I know there's some other good ones, but I think the two of them are sort of at the top of that heap. But he wrote, he wrote crime stories, he wrote Westerns, he wrote historical fiction, everything from sort of stories set in the Aztec Empire to, the conquistadors. He just tried imagining stories in a lot of different types of settings. But he was very invested in solid, well-functioning plots. And that's where, Michael Chabon, who's won the Pulitzer Prize and very esteemed writer in the Bay Area right now. I mean, he told me in an interview that was the main thing he learned from Oakley Hall, and he learned it in the first couple weeks he was being taught by him, was the value of plot. And if you look at the book Michael Chabon wrote that won the Pulitzer, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, that book has a phenomenal plot to it. So, you know, those things are related in a sense, because Chabon told me before he really studied under Oakley Hall, he was just much more invested in entirely character-driven stories. He was just a young writer, just sort of being influenced by whatever he picked up. But it wasn't until he was taught by Oakley Hall, like, what an amazing device a plot can be to get readers invested in a story. Louis B. Jones told me that Oakley's writing style, his fine prose style, was, you know, something that always stayed with him. Amy Tan has written some essays about what Oakley sort of, the way he built her confidence up and gave her the fortitude to believe she could do it. So you'll hear all these great writers have their own little thing they took from encountering him. But yeah, so in 1959, a novel he wrote called Warlock was a finalist for the Pulitzer, and it didn't win. I can't remember what won that year, but it's hard for me to wrap my mind around because that's probably one of my favorite novels of all time.
Mm-hmm. Warlock. In fact, it's I think the year after it was published, there was a pretty well-known movie that came out with Richard Widmark and some other, Henry Fonda. I don't know. Yeah, so a lot of people know Warlock from the older generation from the movie. He was a mentor to a bunch of young students. You mentioned some of them, but he also had a community of writers that they would meet once a month.
Every few times a season up in Olympic Valley, up in the Sierras. And so he was the co-founder of the Community of Writers, which is exists to this day. It's a very influential writers retreat that happens up in the High Sierra Mountains between California and Nevada in the Olympic Valley, also known as Squaw Valley.
The other thing to be mentioned maybe is because we spoke about Ambrose Bierce in our first show, is that he was very taken with Ambrose Bierce himself, and he wrote a few books that were kind of fictional accounts of real events. And like Bierce, he was extremely committed to the denunciation of corruption and, you know, the robber barons and all that kind of, that Wild West story of power imposing itself on the powerless, no?
Yeah. One reason I was able to write such a sort of in-depth profile of Oakley Hall for the San Francisco Chronicle was because so many people in his circle are still with us, but also because Oakley's house, where he wrote all these amazing works of literature, a beautiful old Victorian that survived the great earthquake, one of the only buildings that survived the great earthquake on that particular hill in San Francisco, and pieces of Ambrose Bierce's world that Oakley could see and walk through when he lived in San Francisco are still there. So this was an interesting story to write for the Chronicle, because not only did I have access to Oakley's entire family and all of his famous students, but I could go to this amazing house on McCondry Lane where he created all these magical books. And I could see from his deck the vantage point of all these amazing historical structures and from San Francisco's bygone era that he could see from his deck and that he looked at every morning as he was writing. And that's very important when we get to that series of books he wrote about Ambrose Bierce. So Oakley Hall, it was in the later part of his career, but he began writing a mystery, a historical fiction mystery series in which his lead detective was Ambrose Bierce. Ambrose Bierce, the investigative reporter / newspaper man. And Oakley used a bunch of historical things that had happened in San Francisco at the time for his plots, things that had happened around Bierce as a journalist. And he would then use the character of Bierce as a journalist to sort of unravel these mysteries the way a mystery works. Like, not only did he write crime genre and Western genre, but towards the end of his life, he got very skillful at the mystery genre. And that was through these Ambrose Bierce novels. They're especially the first two are brilliantly written. They're all a lot of fun to read. And the research that he did was so meticulous. And both his daughters said, even some of his students said, he built the most incredible home library for California history, one could imagine. And he just really, at that point in his life, loved doing the research because he was just obsessed with California history. So the research was very fun to him, too, as he was writing these books.
So apart from Warlock, would you recommend in this number two slot maybe one of the Bierce novels?
No, in the number two slot, I would recommend the Western he wrote immediately after Warlock, or not long after Warlock, called The Badlands. Badlands is goddamn fantastic, and it's just like Warlock. It's unbelievable that it's not better known and more read, and that it's so underappreciated. But I mean, I see Warlock as a masterpiece, and I see Badlands as a near masterpiece. They're both so good. But I do recommend, if people want some shorter novels that are faster to read, if they want something that's a little funner and upbeat, then yeah, I would say the first two or three Ambrose Bierce novels are all like a lot of fun to read.
I don't know what to make of the fact that, Jerry Garcia, the first name of the Grateful Dead was Warlocks, before. I don't know if it was inspired by Oakley Hall. I always assumed that it was, but...
Do you know there was a Western rock band that named themselves Oakley Hall?
Oh, no, I didn't know
yes,
that.
Yes, and I believe in the 90s is when they were playing all over the country, and they called themselves Oakley Hall because they loved Warlock so much.
Yeah.
I believe he did. He met them. They when they played in San Francisco, and he was invited to their show, and he and some family members went and got to meet them. And one of his daughters told me it was kind of funny because it was he listened to like classical music and opera and jazz. So this was musically it was not his scene, but he did really appreciate the nod to him that they'd done by naming themselves. So I think he did have a pretty good time when he went and met them.
I'm sure. Well, I don't know if the Warlocks from if the Dead were inspired by Oakley Hall, they probably would have had contact with him and would be on record. So I don't know what to make of that.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. But certainly they were in San Francisco in the same time.
Yes, for sure. So Scott, we want to talk about Hunter S. Thompson as well, because he's a fascinating character. Now we're moving in a bit closer to our time, I guess. And Thompson's well known as being the originator of the so-called gonzo journalism. First, how would you define gonzo journalism? And then we will talk about Thompson himself.
I would define it as a very extreme, unorthodox, uncontained form of journalism that requires one putting themselves in the dead center of the action, typically not very faithful to factual reporting or well-sourced details.
Not like your journalism, in other words, right?
Well, the one reason people gravitated towards gonzo journalism, or we'll say Hunter's style of gonzo journalism, is because even though it's using a lot of invention, even though it's this, oftentimes there's sort of no proof at all that parts of the narrative happened if someone were to try to fact check it, or sometimes there's a bit of a trolling effect on purpose to it, or kind of intentionally gaslighting the reader for fun. Now, Thompson's not the first writer to come through California to do those things. That would have been the young Mark Twain, did all those things as a journalist. But back when Twain did it, this is a time when there's just no way to fact check anything or know what's true or what's not true that you're reading. And it was just a lot easier to write something that totally off the wall and crazy that has a lot of invention mixed in with a lot of fact and just get away with it. Particularly if it's the whole point of the thing is to play an elaborate prank on a community, which is what Twain liked doing. So, but the Thompson's around, it's a whole different world. But I think the reason his form of gonzo journalism resonated so well at the time and has continued to have a deep, abiding fan base is because for all the invention, for all the sort of Jedi mind tricks that are involved in it, it often gets at an essential truth in a way that standard, mainstream, codified writing at the moment is not doing.
So you would call him primarily a journalist?
I would call... Well, there's one of his biographers called him an outlaw journalist. I think that's maybe a handy term. I would say he was a literary journalist who took a great deal of license, you know, while carrying out that work.
Very well known for two books in particular.
Yeah.
The first one being his book on the Hell's Angels.
Yeah. Well, let me just get the... Probably in full disclosure for your listeners, I'm in the middle of doing a podcast documentary on Hunter S. Thompson's time in the California Bay Area. And so I'm interviewing a bunch of people right now who knew him and encountered him. And so I'm very immersed in Hunter's life in sort of between San Francisco and Berkeley between 1965 and 1974 is what I'm really focused on right now. And fortunately, there's a lot of people around who had encounters with him or who worked with him that are still living in the area and that have, you know, pretty vivid memories of all of that. So Hunter got to San Francisco around 1965. He was a regular freelance reporter for a newspaper at the time called the National Review. The National Observer. So, and he was at that time, he was a young journalist. He was a really talented, skillful writer. He pretty much wrote in a mainstream fashion with literary flourishes, and it's very good work. It's very solid, and it's very readable today. So when he arrived in San Francisco, he was, because of the student protests that had started happening at Berkeley and because of the counterculture movement that was beginning in San Francisco, he just thought it was an ideal place to be positioned as a freelance reporter to sell stories to national magazines. He thought this was one of the places where the action was. So he wanted to be on the ground so he could get the best stories. If anyone has ever tried to make their living as a freelance journalist, it's all about constantly trying to sell ideas to different editors. So that's what originally brought him here. It wasn't going terribly well at first. And then The Nation, which was pretty new at the time, The Nation magazine, asked him to do a profile of the Hell's Angels Motorcycle Club. Now, the California Attorney General's office that year had released a report called the Lynch Report that was portraying the Hell's Angels as public enemy number one in the state of California. It accused them of a slew of terrible crimes all up and down the state, without citing a lot of details or evidence to back it up, by the way. But this damning report had been issued, the Lynch Report, about the Hell's Angels. And so that got the media's attention. A couple national newspapers sent reporters down, but those reporters couldn't get anywhere near the Hell's Angels. So what they ended up writing was not very interesting. It was regurgitations, essentially, of the Lynch Report. The Nation asked Hunter, knowing that how desperate he was to make, you know, a living. And I think probably knew by that time, or had heard from the National Observer, that Hunter had a little bit of craziness to him in terms of his fear factor. They asked him to try to write a profile of the Hell's Angels. At the time, the San Francisco Chronicle had a police reporter named Bernie Jarvis, who had been a member of the Hell's Angels. So Hunter knew Bernie Jarvis. Bernie Jarvis helped Hunter actually track the Hell's Angels, the San Francisco chapter of the Hell's Angels, down. And he ended up meeting them one night at a place called the DePauw Hotel, which, best I can tell in all my research, was somewhere around the Central Industrial Waterfront near Hunter's Point. And it doesn't exist anymore. But he spent an entire night drinking with the Hell's Angels. He told them he was going to write a story about them no matter what. And he basically said, "You have nothing to lose by cooperating with me, because if you don't cooperate with me, my story will be just as mediocre as the last two that came out. But if you cooperate with me, I'll be fair, and I'll try to, you know, I'm going to write what I'm going to write, but I'll try to come at it from a more fair perspective." So I think it was simply the fact that he could drink so much that impressed them. They just spent hours and hours drinking cheap beer and wine together. And at one point, Hunter took five of them back to his apartment where his new wife and baby were, and was showing them his guns. Hunter was already a gun nut at the time, which might have endeared him a little more to them. And they could see he was not what they would have called a square. He was not someone like them, but he was also not a square. He was something to them that was just different. He was just kind of his own thing. he wrote that piece for The Nation. It got a lot of attention all over the country, got a big readership, and he was immediately offered a book deal to do a nonfiction journalistic book about the Hells Angels. What the actual agreement was initially with them has really been disputed over the years, but some kind of agreement was reached where Hunter could be, for lack of a better term, embedded with them for about a year. So a lot of the time he was following them in a Rambler, like as they'd go on these rides all over the up and down California. He eventually got his own Harley too and would ride alongside them. He followed them for roughly a year, and then he wrote his book about them. The book was a blockbuster hit, really, really well received critically. So I think today, like, the critical establishment doesn't consider it 100% gonzo, so to speak, but it really showed the most sort of flamboyant, over-the-top, but well-executed style of writing Hunter was capable of. I think it's probably better written in a lot of respects than what would later be called gonzo, because he still had a foot in that other world of, he had one foot in the world of sort of mainstream writing and then one foot in the world of rebel outlaw writing, for lack of a better word, when it came to literary journalism. So that book is a nice amalgam of those two things. So that was his first big hit. The Hells Angels didn't like the book so much, and he had tensions and problems with them for several years after that, but it did serve its purpose in making him a nationally known writer.
Yeah. Amazing chapter of his life there in writing. And, of course, the title that he's probably even better known for is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Huh?
Yeah, that he was kind of away from the Bay Area when he wrote that book, but that book got the attention and was published by Rolling Stones. Rolling Stones had not been around very long. They just started a book division. So they published his they'd read Hell's Angels. Jan Winters and his team had read Hell's Angels, really loved that book. So they ended up publishing Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Then
in serial form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they got this idea to have Hunter be their political reporter for the upcoming presidential campaign. And that's I would say that book, which ultimately became known as Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, is a book that's, even though he traveled all over the country to write it and was in Washington, D.C. a lot, it's a book that's intimately tied to the California Bay Area because he was working for Rolling Stones. He was checking in with Rolling Stones constantly in San Francisco. And then he finished writing the book in the city of San Francisco while he was staying at the Seal Rock over by Sutton's Point. And so, in fact, it's a really interesting story. He did not know how to finish the book, and he just ended up going on a long, isolated drinking binge at the Seal Rock Inn and was not delivering the manuscript to Rolling Stones, and they were coming up against their deadline to publish the book. Ultimately, their book editor, Alan Rinsler, had to go over to the Seal Rock and risk Hunter beating him up, basically, and just talk him into and help him finish the book. And Alan actually played a huge role in that book getting its final chapter finished and getting to publication.
I will confess that I've not read him. I haven't read the Hell's Angels book nor the Fear and Loathing, but if I had to start with one or the other, which one would you recommend?
Some would depend on how interested you are in crime or politics, because the Hell's Angels book isn't so much about crime. It's about social ideas about crime and what constitutes social threats. So it's somewhat in the crime genre, even though there's not a lot of actual crime reported in it. But it's very much about who the public views as criminals and whether or why they do that. So it's very interesting. It's a sociological kind of study in a lot of ways. I think in my Chronicle piece, I called it outlaw ethnography. So that's one way to think about Hell's Angels. Where if you're somebody who is really into politics or political history, then Fear and Loathing in the Campaign Trail might be more interesting. That has some of his most famous passages he ever wrote are in Fear and Loathing in the Campaign Trail. He has this passage where he has a dream, a nightmare of Richard Nixon turning into a werewolf. And it's probably the most brilliant passage he ever wrote. Another interesting thing about that is Hunter first encountered Richard Nixon in San Francisco at the Republican National Convention when Barry Goldwater was the nominee. Hunter was assigned to cover that convention for the National Observer. So when Barry Goldwater got up on stage and gave his famous speech about extremism in the defense of liberty, Hunter was right there on the floor in front of him, and Richard Nixon was on the stage behind Goldwater. And when the crowd erupted wildly, and when Goldwater said that, Hunter had a premonition about a lot of sort of terrible things that were going to happen in the country in the near future, which he turned out to be right about.
So he would definitely fit the category of a drinker with a writing problem, right?
Yeah, I actually hesitated. In season one, I had access to a lot of these same folks, and some of my journalist friends were perplexed that I didn't ultimately end up doing an episode on Hunter in season one, because I had access to a lot of people who knew him and worked with him. I had some conflict on it because he's such an extreme example of a drinker with a writing problem. And alcohol absolutely destroyed his writing ability and his life in the long run. But that is also true of Brendan Behan, who I did my very first episode on. I guess I didn't want more than one figure like that in one season. That's maybe what it came down to. I already had Brendan Behan in season one, who a very similar story as Hunter in terms of the alcoholism got so out of control that first it took his writing and his talent, and then it took his life. And that's true of Hunter too. Well, I should point out for your listeners who don't know, Hunter took his own life, but the alcohol took his talent and took his writing ability and took him to a place where that sort of thing might happen, similar to his idol, Ernest Hemingway. I mean, that was one of Hunter's great idols, and Hunter chose to go out the exact same way.
Yeah, a drinker obsessed with guns as well.
Both of them, Hemingway and Thompson. But, you know, it's not so much a parallel, and it's more of Hunter modeled himself after Hemingway in a lot of ways, you know. So it's not that – I don't think it's independent of each other. I don't think it's a coincidence that Hunter had modeled himself on Hemingway so much that he thought, you know, he decided to end the last chapter the same way.
Well, that's great, Scott. We got through our part two of the California Writers. Thank you for coming on to Entitled Opinions again. And if I was trying to encourage you to think about doing something down the line on Malcolm Lowry and Under the Volcano and his story down in Mexico, and talk about a drinker with a writing problem, that's Malcolm Lowry. And if you go in that direction, you got to let me know.
Well, I think if there is a season three of Drinkers with Writing Problems, I'm just right in the middle of season two. If there ends up being a season three, then Mexico is almost certainly going to be part of it. So that's one of the reasons I would do a season three, is I really want to do an episode on Mexico. But it did not work out for a whole lot of reasons because of the pandemic and a lot of logistical issues that came up with the pandemic. So.
Well, you do one on Mexico, and we'll have you back here at KCSU, right? Entitled Opinions. Okay. Yeah. Well, thanks again. We've been speaking with Scott Thomas Anderson, writer and journalist here in California. And I remind you that he has a documentary series into the second season now called Drinkers with Writing Problems, and it's available on all the podcast platforms. So tune into that. So thanks again, Scott. We'll be in touch soon.
Okay, thanks.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
right away on his silver bike. And apart from that, he'll be so kind in consenting to blow your mind. Fly Translove Airways gets you there on time.
Translove